some members. Senator Starr is excused in district today. We're going to start with Senate Bill 564. Senator Atkinson, you are here from southern region of our state.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Senator Jason Atkinson, representing Southern Oregon. And I thank you for giving this bill a hearing, and thank all the members for coming at 8:15 in the morning to be awoken to my testimony. I won't speak too long. This bill comes at the request of Corporal Jeff Gettings, who came up last night from Grants Pass to be here this morning for the bill. What this bill does is it changes the law with regards to assaulting a law enforcement animal. And with that brief introduction, now I will introduce Corporal Jeff Gettings.
Okay. Corporal, you just state your name for the record and then proceed with your testimony.
I will. Jeff Gettings. I'm a corporal with the Grants Pass Department of Public Safety out of Grants Pass, Oregon. Chairman, members of the committee, I appreciate this opportunity to talk to you this morning. Basically, the goal behind this bill is to give protection to all law enforcement animals. And it does it in two ways. The first thing it does is change the verbiage in existing Oregon revised statute. Right now, protection is offered to police animals that are involved in police work. But that does not include the animals that are used by adult corrections, youth corrections, and colon probation, all of which either are currently or will be using animals in the performance of their duties. So what I'm asking in the first part of this is to change the terminology to law enforcement animal, and specifically to have that include, again, adult corrections, youth corrections, and colon probation animals, so they'll be offered the same protection that police animals are offered now. Secondly, the crime that someone would be committing in Oregon revised statute if they seriously injure or kill a police animal is criminal mischief in the first degree. And basically, that's the same crime that they would be committing if they scratched the paint on your car or broke the handset off of a payphone. And I think that's inadequate for the type of service that these animals are put into. Also, the state of mind that goes into that particular statute is that the prosecutors have to show intent. And what generally occurs in these situations is there's an armed, focused, aggressive attacker that won't listen to police suggestions. They drop their weapon and give themselves up. So a police canine will be sent in. The police canine will contact the attacker, will possibly apply a bite, whatever the case may be. And during the altercation, the attacker will discharge a firearm or use their knife or whatever, killing the law enforcement animal. When it comes time to try that case, the prosecutor has to prove that the person intended to kill that animal. And it's very easy to argue that this was an altercation of an animal, one thing led to another, the gun went off, and the animal is now dead. So what I'm suggesting is that we create a new law, something specifically for law enforcement animals, that puts the level of proof at recklessly, not intentionally. So to remove it from paragraph F from criminal mischief in the first degree and create a separate law that is assaulting a law enforcement animal, which would state that if a person recklessly causes serious physical injury or the death of a law enforcement animal, that they could be convicted of that crime. I guess in summary, obviously law enforcement officers are citizens of their community, and society has placed a little higher value on assaulting a law enforcement officer. If a citizen assaults another or causes physical injury to another citizen, that would be a Class A misdemeanor. However, if a citizen assaults a public safety officer, that would actually be a Class C felony. And what I'm asking for is the same sort of thing to apply to law enforcement animals. If someone cruelly kills an animal, they would be charged with animal abuse, just a Class A misdemeanor. If they kill or seriously injure a law enforcement animal, through this bill, I'm asking that David be charged with a Class C felony of assaulting a law enforcement animal, which is basically the penalty would be the same as it is right now. It just changes the burden of proof slightly.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Brief.
On page 1 of the bill, line 23, you say that assaulting a law enforcement animal is a Class B felony, but you just said Class C felony, which is, am I missing something? I looked at the amendments. I don't see any change.
The bill actually makes it a higher felony to assault an animal than it does.
That was what I initially suggested for the bill, and also to make it a Class 8 on the sentencing guidelines. Since then, I've asked basically for it to be, through an amendment, for it to be dropped down to a Class C and a Level 6. And I apparently didn't get that through. What I'm asking for is not for the penalty right now to necessarily change, but for the burden of proof to change, so that the prosecutor won't have to show that they specifically set out with the intent of killing this law enforcement animal, that just through their reckless actions can cause the death of this animal.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Brady.
When you say you're not looking for the penalty to change, are you saying that you would be satisfied with criminal mischief as being the penalty if the burden of proof has changed?
I think criminal mischief 1 is a Class C felony at a Level 6. I think the problem is if we change the burden of proof to reckless in criminal mischief 1, that all the other things that go in criminal mischief 1 would also be changed to a recklessness. And rather than change all of the paragraphs under criminal mischief 1, it seems like it could be a better course of action to create something separate for law enforcement animals in and of themselves.
Keeps the fiscal down anyway, I think. All right. Okay, got a couple of questions for you. We've got Susan Russell, the Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, but it appears to me in the language that it really doesn't delineate that the person knows or would reasonably know that the animal is a law enforcement animal. So how do you distinguish between a law enforcement animal as opposed to some other animal? Do you, you know, police dogs, you know, wear an identification?
Right. Right now, all of the police animals that I know are used, and that includes the mounted police force, etc., all wear identifying marks, whether it's basically a vest that has police written all over it or wearing an actual badge, whatever the case may be. So it would be readily evident to a person that it would be a law enforcement animal.
So it sounds to me like your intent is that the person would know or would have recently known that the animal is a law enforcement animal.
Yes.
All right. Although the bill doesn't say that. But okay. And then are there other animals used in law enforcement other than dogs and horses?
I do not know of any other.
I thought I saw something about a pot-bellied pig. I don't mean to lie in this, but...
And if that's the case, they should be included. I just don't know of any other.
Cats? Do we have a cat lover here, too? I think their cats might have some value here.
Put cats in and I have hands.
Well, we may want to, I mean, if we're going to move ahead with this, we may want to include or any other animal that has a legitimate law enforcement purpose or something. And I don't know, just in case. Because there actually is some pot-bellied pig being used by somebody, and I don't know what they do.
Find truffles.
Find truffles?
That would be my guess, too.
Okay, find truffles. Senator Burial.
No, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess the questions that I have is how often do we have police or law enforcement animals assaulted or injured? Is there any statistics that, you know, would help us get a handle on the size of the problem?
I don't have those particular statistics with me. I basically searched the internet and came across thousands of pages, memorial pages, dedicated to particular law enforcement animals which were killed on line of duty. And I can't give you statistics specifically for Oregon, but it does happen with, unfortunately, a fairly great frequency.
Good news is you don't have to provide a pension for the family. Senator Farrell, another question?
Another question, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I'm under the impression that the dogs are trained to subdue and they're sent into situations that are significantly dangerous and that they do protect the lives and safety of public officers. I'm also, I guess, under the impression that they're trained very highly and very specifically. But I'm also wondering if dogs are allowed to bite suspects after they're subdued. I've heard and seen some video that indicates that after the suspect is on the ground, the dog's allowed to bite almost as a closure of the training exercise. So I'd like to ask you about what are the controls that are used on law enforcement dogs to keep them from biting subdued suspects.
Chairman, Senator Farrioli, I have to tell you that I'm not an expert in canine handling techniques. What I do know is that does not seem to be an appropriate use of a law enforcement canine. Generally, they're used as a searching tool and as an apprehension tool. But once the person is taken into custody, it's my understanding that the dog is called off and human officers come in and apply the handcuffs, etc. Unless the person was involved in some sort of continuing activity that would force the use of a law enforcement animal.
And I'm not an expert in canine use either, but my recollection of familiarization courses is that they are trained to harass but not bite. I mean, if that's a distinction, it's very small. In other words, they may appear to be biting, but their mouths are trained to be soft.
They are certainly...
They don't clench down as hard as they can. Interesting.
They are certainly a visual deterrent.
Right.
To continue that
I had a guy years ago up in a tree as a burglar, up in a tree, and we found him, you know, way up in a tree, and he comes down, and the dog's doing what it's doing, kind of, you know, barking and stuff like that, and the guy's asking the question, says, what's the name of that dog? And the handler mentioned the name of the dog. He goes, I don't think I've been bitten by that one yet. So this guy apparently had a myriad of experiences being chased by police dogs. Senator Marengo.
Thank you. Thanks for coming this morning. I just want to explore for a little bit the reasons to go from intentional to reckless. And you said it's because sometimes in the struggle of the apprehension or the arrest, the offender may perhaps stab the dog with a knife or shoot the dog, and it's hard to prove that that was done intentionally. Is that what you're getting at?
Yes. Because these confrontations are rapidly evolving, and obviously they're dealing with an aggressive armed suspect.
Yeah.
The dogs are sent in because it's too dangerous for a human officer to go in there. Generally, the only eyewitness you have is the suspect themselves. And, you know, the officers show up, and here's this dead canine, and they say, geez, the dog bit me. And the gun went off, and I'm sorry, but I didn't intend to do that. It was just something that occurred. And I think that's a huge level of proof that has to be met. Ultimately, the result is the same. They didn't cooperate with law enforcement that were there.
Yeah.
They didn't follow commands, and now the animal is dead. I hate to see them get off because we can't show that they set out specifically intending to kill the animal.
Right. I mean, I would appreciate your opinion, Greg, as far as... In the circumstance he just described, would it be hard to prove intent?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I don't want to disagree with the corporal's understanding, but I believe there's a difference between a specific intent to kill, like you'd have in a, like say, an aggravated murder. Here the intent is just intentionally, and that means that the act must be an act that was done with a conscious objective. So I don't think it would be... Does that make any sense? You have to show that the act was with a conscious objective, say, of hitting the animal or striking the animal, or I don't know if there's a weapon involved or whatever. But that is different from if you were proving an aggravated murder and you had to prove with the intent to kill, a specific intent. So I think there is a difference. So it would be easier to prove intentionally kill an animal than than, say, a murder case where you have to prove when they shot the gun, for example, they had the specific intent to kill, not just that they consciously pulled the trigger.
So we could write this so that it actually restated what you're telling us, that, that the person intentionally hit or stabbed or shot.
Mr. Chairman, if you leave it the way it's written, I was looking at the animal abuse in the first degree, which says a person intentionally, knowingly, or recklessly causes serious physical injury to an animal or cruelly causes the death of an animal. In that case, if you, you know, intentionally would just mean with an intentional act.
Mm-hmm.
As I recall, this is one of the sections that we amended last session, Mr. Chairman, and it has some difficult language in it for a death of an animal, where the adverb cruelly causes death of an animal was put in, and I believe that was done because there was concern of, on behalf of private citizens, that they have to put a dog down, basically. You know, obviously they didn't want to be prosecuted for that. So there could be a little bit of work in that area if you wanted something for a higher standard. Of course, the way the bill is written, it says reckless. So if you can prove a higher state of mind, you could still sustain a conviction. If you could prove it was knowingly or intentionally done, you could also get a
Senator Ringo.
I mean, just to follow up on this, but I guess I'm concerned about creating a situation where we reduce the level of intent required because it's hard to get the evidence. The goal should be to make the crime match the conduct. And the circumstance you described to me makes sense. I mean, that conduct deserves punishing. And I don't have any problem with that. I just want to make sure that that we don't allow for the punishment to go where the conduct is less severe.
Okay.
And so I just want to explore with Craig just a little bit more whether the circumstance he described, where police dog goes into a house, big hullabaloo, gun goes off, dog is dead. Are you gonna be able to prove general intent?
Mr. Chairman,
as the statute's currently written,
Senator Ringo, you can't obviously have to be more than a big hullabaloo, but it would be just like any case. If you could show that a person pointed a gun at the, you know, at the dog, or I assume it was a dog, and discharged several, you know, rounds, I don't think I'd have a problem showing that that was intentional. But that might just be. Again, I think we're getting back to the difference between. I think maybe the corporal's understanding of intent to kill from homicide would be different from this. So, it's very fact specific, as you know. I mean, in every case, it boils down to the facts. And if there's, you know, if he's saying get that dog off me and shooting at it, I think that'd be a pretty good case.
But I could see where he's saying that there are going to be no witnesses. There's going to be the offender who's going to. Yeah, I shot the dog. I didn't mean to do it. And, of course, the DA would be saying, well, you pulled a gun, yes. You pulled the trigger, yes. You pointed at the dog, yes. Okay, then.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ringo, that's one of the difficulties we dealt with animals, for example. That's true. There's not a witness that can testify, of course, and there's not the kind of forensic evidence that you'd probably invest in it, and frankly, and as a murder trial, which would cost, you know, so much money. And that's one of the issues too. When proving injury, for example, with an animal, we amended the statutes last session because normally with injury you ask the victim how long did it hurt, or did it hurt, or on a scale of 1 to 10. Well, you can't do that with a dog, so there are some difficulties that surround it.
And it gets me to, hang on just 1 second, the question of serious physical injury versus physical injury. How you predict that?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, it's a good question. Physical injury and serious physical injury, I'll start by saying there's a broad difference. Physical injury is substantial pain or I have to look at the statute. Serious physical injury is loss of limb or, you know, use. And I can get the exact definition, but suffice to say, serious physical injury is in our terms, is a very serious physical injury.
Well,
if you want me to, I'll get the definitions if you want.
But it does get back to the proof question you discussed, because I'm making serious physical injury questions. You might ask the witness on the stand, have you suffered a permanent impairment,
right,
or an inability to use a particular limb or body part, et cetera, and the witness might be able to say, yes, I can't move my arm above a certain level anymore.
Right. And Mr. Chairman, serious physical injury, here's the quote, means physical injury that creates a substantial risk of death or that causes protracted disfigurement, protracted impairment of health, or protracted loss or impairment of the function of a limb or bodily organ. Mr. Chairman, in prosecutions that you're going to prove serious physical injury, very common to have a medical expert or, you know, a doctor explain that. And physical injury, then, as I recall the cases interpreting it, I think there was one case that said if you could prove pain that lasted for more than an hour, that would be physical injury. So usually in physical injury, we're talking about a much, much lower standard.
Okay. Senator Burdick.
If I could follow up on a question that Senator Ringo asked, you said the standard in the animal abuse statute is recklessly or intentionally, or there was a third one.
There's intentionally, animal abuse in the first degree, Senator, intentionally, knowingly, or recklessly causes serious physical injury to an animal. What's interesting about animal abuse in the first degree, it then says, or cruelly causes the death of an animal. And one of the things that we struggled with is, as an attorney, trying to prove what, for example, you couldn't prove recklessly, cruelly causing the death of an animal. So we had some struggles in trying to figure that out. Again, we put in the word cruelly, because of the concerns.
I was more interested in the use of either intentionally or recklessly or knowingly, and wondering if that might be appropriate here, because you wanted a recklessness standard, and if you could provide either of those three, whether that might be consistent.
Go ahead. I say, Corporal, so you understand, I don't want you to be confused about what's going on here. We're actually trying to help, I think. It looks a lot like making sausage. We're going back and forth. You might be wondering what's happening to the bill, but sometimes you get into these complex questions.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Burdick, when a statute reads recklessly cause serious physical injury, the prosecutor could prove more than that and sustain a conviction. However, it's nice to have an election, so that when you have a jury instruction, you could say intentionally if that fit the pattern, so there's not a confusion.
Well, and that's knowingly is a lower standard. So if somebody, you know, shot off their gun and knew that the dog was there, then that would be even a lower standard.
And Mr. Chairman and Senator Burdick, it might be helpful to go over. Intentionally means a conscious objective to do the act. Knowingly means you're aware of that a circumstance exists, so you're aware of. Recklessly means you see an unjustifiable risk of a certain thing happening, and you disregard that. Most commonly, again, we have, you know, we all know that from reckless driving. So intentionally is the most difficult, or the highest standard, knowingly, then recklessly, and then the lowest standard in criminal law is criminal negligence, which I believe we talked about on the a few days ago on the manslaughter and criminal neg homicide bills.
Senator Ringo.
I just another question for counsel. Would it make sense to consider making this so that instead of reckless, it's knowingly? So it's less than intentional, but higher than reckless. Can we do that?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ringo, I think that's a policy decision for you to make. I mean, you would not be able to. When you mentioned the hullabaloo, like a, you know, I assume a dog is like a bar fight, and a lot of times it's hard to prove in a bar fight that someone's intentionally hitting the person. But I think that's a, it's you know, a a dog case where someone, it might be that the proof problem that the corporal's talking about is just a proof problem of there's no witness, and that's a very difficult thing to do. But I think it's a clear policy decision. If you want reckless behavior in there, you know, that's the issue. But if I don't think we have to take it down to reckless to prove knowing if that's...
Okay. You're getting just where you're going here, Senator Walker.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to hear from Ms. Russell because she often has some ideas about where we might go to make it a better bill.
Okay, I think that's a good idea, unless you want to give us any final response or admonition. Or
Mr. Chairman, I guess one thing I would like to say is that one of the key words in law enforcement now, or key phrases at least, occurs when you're involved in some sort of a fight. And if you have a firearm in your hand and you grab something with this hand, the sympathetic response is to squeeze with your second hand as well. And I would hate for someone, because there are no witnesses, to say, geez, I grabbed the dog and, you know, I had the gun in my hand and it was pointed. You know, I didn't intentionally, I didn't knowingly, I didn't, you know, but I still fired this firearm into this dog's head and killed the dog. And I'd hate for that to be a standard response for people that are killing law enforcement animals. I discussed a little bit with our local district attorney's office, and they felt it would be a lot more appropriate to go to lower the level of proof to that, just to take away that argument, that sympathetic reflex during one of these altercations. I mean, they certainly could have dropped the weapon. They certainly could have theoretically complied with the police orders, but since they didn't, since the dog had to be sent in, and there's no witnesses, I think they're going to get off scot-free.
Let me ask you a question. Are you really focusing more on where an individual is resisting or fleeing an apprehension? You know, it's the suspect on foot that's into the blocks. Or are you talking about, I know we've had instances in Portland where the police horse is tied up now outside of a, you know, a restaurant or something, and somebody comes up and stabs the horse or that kind of incident where there's no fleeing by the suspect. It's an intentional.
Mr. Chairman, most of these occur during some sort of violent confrontation, an autoviolent confrontation, and whether that's at the end of a pursuit, a foot pursuit or whatever the case may be. I don't know of any cases where somebody, you know, sat a rifle down on the street and picked off dogs or horses. You know, that would be easy to show intent. But because of the nature of so many of these calls, they're a resistive attacker, and generally the person has committed some crime to justify the use of the police canine. Because it's not just done for crowd control, it's not just done at lower things, it's they've done something to justify that level of force. And the dog is sent, and unfortunately they're much faster than we are, and they'll turn a corner and they'll apprehend the attacker. And all this happens away from any other witnesses. And the officers will show up, and the dog will be dead. And it's all up to our attacker, who's quite honestly trying to save their own tail.
Right. Thank you. I think that's helpful. We'll get Susan up here and see what she has to say. How are you today, Susan?
Good, thank you.
Good.
Susan Russell on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Lawyers Association, and we're here in opposition to Senate Bill 564 as it's currently drafted. I've prepared some written testimony with some hypotheticals and also kind of a comparison between the current law and Senate Bill 564, and I have a number of thoughts about problems and maybe some ways to address some of those problems. I think, as already been said, Senate Bill 564 would create this new crime of assaulting a law enforcement animal. We have no objection to the expanded addition of a law enforcement animal. That's not a problem we have with this bill. It would take this offense out of the criminal mischief statute and put it into the separate criminal provision. Under current law, a person commits the crime of criminal mischief in the first degree if the person, and this is the language in the statute, with intent to damage property, damages or destroys a police animal, and the animal suffers death or serious physical injury. Criminal mischief is a Class C felony. Senate Bill 564 creates a more serious offense with greater penalties, while at the same time reducing the culpable mental state that a defendant must have. So obviously that's a concern to us, and it's apparently a concern to some members of the committee. I've outlined the differences between criminal mischief one and the new offense. I know there's been reference to it, the intention being, or that there's been a rethinking that it should be only a Class C felony, not a Class B felony. The proposed amendment, the dash one amendments to 564, actually changed the crime category for sentencing, but I don't see anywhere in the amendments that it reduces it to a Class C felony. So here's what I've outlined. Criminal mischief is a Class C felony, so it's punishable by up to 5 years in prison. Assaulting a law enforcement animal is currently drafted as a Class B, so punishable by 10 years. Criminal mischief one is a Category 6 crime when a police animal is injured. And I think it's important to be aware that already under current law, that's sort of an aggravating factor. Your general criminal mischief in the first degree, which is a felony, Class C felony, requires that you damage more than you cause more than $750 worth of damage. It comes in as a level 2 crime. So it can go up, depending on the amount of damage, to level 2, 3, 4. The highest a criminal mischief goes up is to a level 6. So that would be the equivalent for property damage of causing $50,000 or more of damage. And that is where all police animal criminal mischief offenses are all category 6, irrespective of the level of damage. Assaulting a law enforcement animal, as I say, is classified as a crime category 8. There's a proposal under the Dash 1 amendments to have it a category 8. If death occurs, a category 6, which would be the same as where it is now, if it's only serious physical injury. I think this difference between a category 6 and a category 8 is important, because what it means is that if you're in a Category 8, irrespective of your criminal history, meaning if you have no criminal history, you are presumptive prison. So with no criminal history as a Category 8 offense, the presumptive sentence is 16 to 18 months prison. A Category 6 is sort of is classified, I think, is a higher-end felony, but it's sort of right on the edge, so that someone with no criminal history or little criminal history is a presumptive probation sentence. Whereas somebody with a higher criminal history, let's say 4 or more felonies of any type, doesn't have to be person felonies, is a presumptive prison. So in our opinion, Category 6 is a better place for an offense like this to be, because it really does draw a distinction between people with no criminal history or little and people with criminal history. And again, the most important thing is that the difference between the criminal mischief one offense, which requires an intent to damage, and assaulting a law enforcement animal offense, which can be committed recklessly. And in our opinion, that is too low of a mental state. I've given some examples that of conduct that would become a crime under Senate Bill 564, which wouldn't be at present. An example of a person backing out of their driveway without looking carefully, and a police horse is in the vicinity and is seriously injured. And seriously injury has already been defined for you. I've set that out at the end of my testimony. The horse limps for the rest of his life because he's hit by the car, would be serious physical injury. That would be...
Senator Ringo.
I mean, isn't that just simple negligence, though? The conduct that you described?
Well, I think that it is arguably reckless when someone doesn't look. If you drove out and you looked and you didn't look good enough, then I think that would be negligence. It's arguable whether it would be criminal negligence, but it would be negligence. If you drove out of your driveway, I think, and you don't look, then arguably that could be reckless behavior.
Okay.
It, disregarding a risk is really where the recklessness goes.
Senator Burdick has a question.
I'm looking down your examples. I can't believe that someone feeding a police dog a bar of chocolate would reach the standard of recklessness. You'd have to have medical knowledge to know that chocolate is bad for dogs.
Mr. Chair, Senator Berg, you may know that. I mean, let's say you're aware of that. Let's say you're aware that chocolate is potentially fatal for a dog because of the chemicals it has.
Well, that might be the noise, but that would not classify as reckless.
It'd be reckless because you'd disregard a risk, and that's really where that kind of behavior could potentially come in. I think examples, well, I've given other examples in the context of protest rally, because those are sometimes, or peace marches and matters such as that, where you have a lot of people and things happen with crowd disbursement or with people being crowded together. I've given an example of somebody sort of pushing to get air or room who pushes other people into a police animal that's present, and because of the weight of the people involved, the police animal is seriously injured. And I've also given an example of behavior in a park where somebody is not disregards risks and an animal is injured through the throwing of a baseball that hits a police dog in the eye. Another thing I think to be aware of, which is a concern, is that the person may not know it is a police dog. There's no requirement under Senate Bill 564 that the actor be know that it is a police dog. And we're talking about situations where the police dogs are sent ahead. I think we've heard about it in the context in terms of it can be a hard proof issue when there's just a police dog or animal and the defendant who's charged with a crime. It can also be a situation where the individual does not know or is not aware that it is a police animal because the dog or other animal is not accompanied by a police officer. It may be night, it may be dark. You may also have a situation where the police animal overreacts, or that the police animal becomes in contact with an innocent bystander. Something goes wrong. Under Oregon law, you have a self-defense, a statutory right to self-defense. You can defend both yourself and others. But that defense allows you to use reasonable force to defend a person, either yourself or another. It doesn't provide that you can use force in self-defense upon an animal. So I think there's some concern with respect to that aspect as well, that there's nothing in this bill that requires that the individual know that the animal is a police animal, and there's nothing that would allow self-defense in this context, because the self-defense statute is phrased in terms of using force upon another person, not animal. And I think the most troubling thing here is when we're looking at the mental states, I understand by the proponent his concern, which I agree, I think, in some ways with committee counsel, is that that's more sort of a characterization of proof problems. And sometimes we try to lower mental states in order to get at the proof problems, which are going to be there and really probably aren't the problem. It's not probably the mental state that's the problem. It's proof problems when there are not witnesses. And I think to show you how concerning this can be is, I think what my last part of my testimony sort of outlined in written form, and I'd like to go through quickly, is just that this bill would put causing serious physical injury or death to an animal, a police animal, on a higher level than causing injury to a police officer or to a civilian. If you recklessly cause serious physical injury or death to a human being, it is a misdemeanor crime in Oregon law. It is a Class A misdemeanor. In order for it to go higher, there must be additional elements, and I've outlined what those are. For a Class C felony, assault in the third degree, an individual who causes reckless injury must also either be armed with a deadly or dangerous weapon or act under circumstances that manifest extreme indifference to the value of human life. For it to constitute a Class B felony, as Senate Bill 564 currently does, the defendant must act recklessly and use a deadly or dangerous weapon and act under circumstances manifesting an extreme indifference to the value of human life. So Senate Bill 564 would make assaulting a police animal more serious than assaulting a human being. Likewise, Senate Bill 564 would also make assaulting a police animal more serious than assaulting a police officer. Assaulting a police officer is a Class C felony, not a Class B felony. It is ranked as a Category 6 crime. It is not a Category 8 crime. In addition, the person must act intentionally or knowingly. That is the mental state when we're talking about assaulting a a public safety officer. And the assault must occur while the officer is acting in the course of official duty. There is no requirement that the police animal be acting in the course of official duty. The animal could be at home. I know a lot of times with police dogs that they live with the officer with whom they're assigned as their trainer. The animal could be being exercised or be at the residence. By elevating the crime of assaulting a police animal from presumptive to probation to presumptive prison, for those with low criminal records, I think there also is a concern of a financial impact of this bill, and also by reducing the mental state to reckless. I think that potentially more individuals could fall within, and then maybe increase criminal liability and increase court and prison costs. So in our position, the Class C felony is the appropriate place for this type of offense to be. A Category 6, which is what assaulting a public safety officer is categorized, is an appropriate level, and that's where the offense currently is. And then we also believe strongly that a higher mental state than recklessness is appropriate. At present, it's with intent to damage. It's under the criminal mischief statute, and there is an argument perhaps that it's sort of awkwardly stuck into the criminal mischief statute. It's one of a number of ways that criminal mischief, which is primarily a property damage statute, can be committed. Intentional is really requires a conscious objective, not an intent to cause serious physical injury or an intent to kill, but simply a conscious objective to do an act that has certain consequences. So I agree completely with committee counsel in his characterization that there's no requirement by leaving the mental state at intentional that the individual intend to kill or intend a specific consequence, such as that the animal is limp or that the animal loses an organ. If the concern is with the use of a deadly weapon, which is a deadly weapon is really a gun or something to that extent. It's something that's manufactured specifically for the purposes of causing death to be used in those contexts. There are other alternatives, such as, for example, that to act intentionally, knowing that the animal is a police animal, or to act knowingly with the use of a deadly weapon, which would give you a lower mental state, requiring an awareness, not a conscious objective, together with the weapon aspect, which seems to have been part of the concern that I hear from the proponent. Those are my thoughts, and I'm open to questions.
Susan, how would you define the normal duties of a law enforcement animal?
Mr. Chair, I'm certain that that could be defined, but I'm not sure that my expertise is great enough to do that in that...
I'm not looking for expertise. I'm looking for your keen legal mind.
Well, I think that it would be that when the animal is being used for law enforcement purposes or some words to that effect... I think it's we have course in the duty being used for. So I think it would have to be obviously it's not the dog's intent, or it would have to be the intent of the law enforcement trainer or supervisor that is putting the dog into action. So I think animal would be used for law enforcement purposes, or being actively used for law enforcement purposes. I think that would exclude when the dog is sort of being taken for a walk by potentially with no marks on the dog and nothing to identify as a police dog and
right. Gets
into a bad interaction with someone.
Right.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And that point was something that I had highlighted in your presentation as well, because I think there could be a situation where the police dog is at home, maybe it's in the backyard, and somebody's next door dog. Well, I wouldn't put a next-door dog in with a police dog any day. I don't think the police dog would probably win in that situation. But I just think there could be some place where a police dog could be injured off-duty, and I would not want that to be under a higher standard because the dog was not acting in the performance of its duties, and I think that could be easily defined. And so I appreciate that distinction.
All right. So, Susan, I've got another question, Senator.
I do, Mr. Chairman, but it's for the proponents of the bill.
All right. Great. Great. Any other additional comments?
No, those are my comments.
So I take it from your testimony that you have problems with the current construct, but you're willing to facilitate coming to some reasonable resolution.
Mr. Chair, certainly. It is a crime, and I think that there is perhaps a more artful way to address this than to have it in the criminal mischief, which is really a property damage statute. So
let me ask you this question on the amendments, the -1 amendments, where the crime category 8 is being used if the animal dies, as opposed to the crime category 6 if the animal is subject to serious physical injury. How do you feel about those amendments?
Yeah. Mr. Chair, it's our opinion that a category 6 would be appropriate in both circumstances.
For either circumstance.
That is a serious level of felony. And, of course, by keeping it as a category 6, there are different ways that an animal can die. And, of course, with a category 6, the judge could always has the option to depart upwards and to impose a more significant sentence depending upon the circumstances. So because Category 6 is sort of a serious place, presumptive prison for people with criminal records, I think that that's an adequate place for the court. Let's say if there really is the death under sort of egregious circumstances, for the court to really give a significant punishment.
All right. Thank you very much. Senator Atkinson, Mr. Getting, Corporal Getting, excuse me. Senator Farrelly has a question for you.
Mr. Chairman, I think you're on that line with Ms. Gettings or Corporal Gettings. It appeared to me that the intention of the proponents was to change the penalty schedule, and that modification did not actually get included in the bill file. But I understand that some definitions would be worked on, and perhaps the proponents would care to talk about an amendment at this point in time.
Do you understand the question?
Again, my name is Jeff Gettings with the Grants Pass Department of Public Safety. Mr. Chairman, Senator Farrelly, initially, when I first kind of started this about a year ago, I felt that level 8 across the board would be appropriate. However, in doing some research and realizing that causing physical injury, just physical injury to a human officer would be a level 6, I felt that serious physical injury to a police animal should be about the same thing. I'm not asking for the same coverage as a human, but I think society itself affords a little higher protection to those that are in charge of keeping care of society, going into those hazardous environments. So serious physical injury, I think, is certainly loss of limb, which was an example that would be that a Category 6 in sentencing would be appropriate for that. I think, however, if somebody, again, in reality, the way these things happen is these rapidly evolving violent situations, and if through an attacker's actions they cause that animal's death, I think that a level 8 would be appropriate. And someone with no criminal background, that's my understanding, with no criminal background, that it would not be mandatory prison, but it would certainly be an option for those that have a continually violent background.
All right. Senator Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Corporal, are you comfortable with making sure that the police animal is working or the law enforcement animal is working on the job to have this new standard apply? That you wouldn't want someone to go to prison for accidentally killing a law enforcement animal when it was not in the performance of its duties, would you?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Walker, I think generally the way this occurs is when the animal is in performance of its duties. However, by nature of what we do for a living, we get people that are after us, and they do attack our homes, they do attack our property. And what I wouldn't want to see is an animal, just because it was after 5 o'clock and the animal was taken back home again, somebody could freely kill the animal and not have to suffer the consequences. I think it's probably a good idea to show that that person knew that it was a law enforcement animal, and that may be difficult to prove, and that would be up to the DA's office to do. But I think it's not one of those things where just because the animal gets home free, they're home, now someone can kill them and not commit this crime. I think if they're at work, if that person knows they're a law enforcement animal, or if they're at home, if that person knows they're a law enforcement animal, that the penalty should be the same. The same way it would be is if I'm at home and someone attacks me at my house, knowing that I'm a police officer, that the level society has afforded to police officers is basically one step higher than the average citizen. And that's basically what I'm asking for in this bill, is if you cruelly kill an animal, it'd be animal abuse one. But what I'm asking for is if you know that that animal is a law enforcement animal, whether it's at home or whether it's at work, and you kill that animal, or you seriously cause serious physical injury to that animal, that it would be one step higher as well, because of virtue of what that dog does for a living or what that horse does for a living.
And I guess I would suggest that, although I understand what you're saying, for the purpose of what we need to do in constructing a law that's passable, that is an issue that's somewhat tangential, and although theoretically possible, it may not be as probable as the death of an animal who's pursuing a fleeing felon or something of that nature. So let me tell you before we close what direction I'm going with this for counsel. You guys can shoot holes in it if you want, but basically I would rewrite it so that it said that a person commits the crime of assaulting a law enforcement animal being used for official law enforcement purposes if the person knows the animal is a law enforcement animal and knowingly causes serious physical injury to or death of the law enforcement animal. And then I would add the amendments, the dash one amendments, with a little caveat under the crime category 8 that it becomes a crime category 8 in the sentencing guidelines grid of the commission if the person causes the death of law enforcement animal during the course of resisting arrest or fleeing the scene of a felony, something of that nature, so that you constrain it and kind of focus on specific purpose. But that's just my little take on it. We'll throw this in counsel's lap. Susan, you can participate with Mr. Prinz in helping to construct something that may work.
And Mr. Chairman, I only want to put out that now we need to statute after your question is actually that the offender can return a deceased animal that has some of the definitions that we talked about, such as that a person knows or reasonably should know that the animal is a deceased animal, and that the animal is being used in a lawful discharge.
Right. All right. So I think we know where we're going with this thing, and I think we can construct something that will work. Senator Atkinson, any closing comments?
Chairman, no, I don't. I would throw myself upon the mercy of your chairmanship, as I have fed Labrador Retrievers chocolate chip cookies for years before I knew it was bad.
Yeah.
Well, ignorance is no excuse. Thank you very much. Sure. We'll close the public hearing then on this bill. And let's see, we have Senate Bill 505. Start a public hearing on that. Then there's a gentleman from Senator Starr's office here. Did you want to come up first and chat about this bill?
Chair, Minister, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Ken McDermott. I'm the legislative assistant to Senator Charles Starr. I apologize for not having prepared written testimony. I found out this morning that Senator Starr wasn't going to be here on the committee. SB 505 was originally drafted to address an incongruity between the state statutes that address homeschooling, that is ORS 339035, and administrative rules. It was originally intended to cover all state agencies. When we sent it down to LC, they came back and said it only needs to apply to DPSST, Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. Under ORS 339035, the state-recognized standards for homeschooling are established, and most homeschoolers have a question, well, after we've accomplished our homeschool education, will the work we've done be recognized by both higher education authorities and potential employers? The homeschool community is rather diverse. Some homeschoolers, when they complete their homeschool education, will take the GED test, and almost all of them successfully pass it. Others consider that the work they've already done, especially since it was in compliance with state statute, should be recognized as being equivalent to a high school education. The issue under federal law has been pretty much resolved. Back in November, there was a Federal Department of Education ruling that addressed one of the key issues, which was whether or not homeschoolers were eligible for federal student aid. States are still working through some of those issues. Since we dropped SB 505, we became aware that the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training is amending its administrative rule to eliminate one of the key phrases, which was a requirement of graduation from an accredited high school. That is being modified to a high school diploma. Other language in the administrative rule, and I believe Diane Middle from the Department of Public Standards, Safety and Training, the director, will testify to this change. With that change, we believe that the issues raised under SB 505 would be addressed, and that with those changes in the administrative rule, SBS 505 would actually not be necessary. We have to take any questions you might have.
All right. So you're basically saying the bill's not necessary, assuming that the department changes its administrative rule.
Correct? Chairman, if that's correct.
I'm following this. Diane, you want to come up here and chat about this for a second? I always find these issues of accreditation interesting because there are some schools that are not high schools, but actually colleges that are not accredited, not because the quality of education is not high enough, but rather because the accrediting institutions refuse to accredit a school governed by a church. That if the board is a church, the organization is a church, they refuse to acknowledge it. But if it was a separate independent corporation, they would. It's kind of fascinating levels of discrimination we find there. But anyway, Diane.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Diane Middle, Director of Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. As Mr. McDermott indicated, not specifically for this reason, but a number of issues had come up causing us to take another look at the language in that rule this past year. As you know, the board sets the standards and the department must apply those standards. And there always has been an educational standard, and for some 20 years it had been accredited high school or GED. Plus, we've also always accepted other documentation that would get us there. As I indicated last year, they began the process of amending that rule, have eliminated the word accreditation from the high school standard, and also the rule does allow us to accept other documentation. So I've had discussions with Mr. McDermott, and it was our understanding that with that change, this probably was not a necessary rule. The only thing that I did want to bring to your attention is there is sort of a, not necessarily a companion, but at least a related bill, Senate Bill 761. That's the only one that actually causes some concern, because apparently what it's designed to do is eliminate some of the standards that the homeschooling now has. The only challenge that creates for us is then what is it that we look at to determine that an appropriate education has occurred. However, I do believe our administrative rules, they're actually due to go back to the executive board at the April 3rd meeting. They have already been through public comment, and so they should go into permanent rule on April 3rd, if I said that right.
Thank you. Question, Senator Walker.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. That raised a question in my mind. What are the standards? How do we know that what the children are being taught at home have been met at standard? Do they have to pass some test or show some proof of the knowledge?
Chairman, it's Senator Walker. I'm probably not the right person to answer that, but in the little bit of research that I have done, it's my understanding that they take a series of tests every so many years through their homeschooling that is overseen by the Department of Education.
Okay. Mr. McDermott, do you want to answer the question?
Thank you, Chairman. Senator Walker, under that current statute, homeschoolers are required to take, first of all, they're required to register that they're homeschooling with their local ESD. That registration stays in effect until they change their status, that is, they move to another ESD or something to that effect. They're required to take standardized achievement tests from a list approved by the State Department of Education in grades 3, 5, 8, and 10. They have to make satisfactory educational progress, which is defined in the administrative rule as scoring above the 15th percentile or higher than they scored on their previous standardized test. If they score lower than that, then they must take a test the following year. If, for instance, if a child in the third grade scored at the 12th percentile, they would have to take a test again in the fourth grade and score at least as high as they did on the previous test. In the event they don't do that, the Department of Education has several options, one of which is to remand back to public school, another is to require tutors or some other effort on the part of the parent.
Yes, thank you. And the reason I'm asking this is because I want to know if they're going to waive the rules and allow homeschoolers to apply. I want to make sure that the department knows that they've actually been schooled properly. So my question is, where they're required to be tested, where is the testing? Where does it take place? It doesn't take place in the home where no one can oversee that someone isn't filling in the blanks and looking it up in a book, is it?
Yeah, Chairman and Senator Walker, the test has to be administered by a qualified individual, which is defined by rule to mean someone who has the experience and training in taking the tests, and they must be neutral in relation to the student.
Okay, great. Thank you. And so you're... I'm sorry. So your question was a little in response, was that Senate Bill 761 would remove some of those standards, and so that would concern you?
Chairman and Senator Walker, that isn't my concern. It's with that bill.
Okay.
Not my concern.
I assume that bill's in Senate Education.
Chairman, that is correct.
All right. Thank you. That answers my question.
I was going to say, if I knew we were going to have this particular discussion, I would have brought some examples of law enforcement police reports. College-educated police officers, and just pass them around and let you read what they write. It's amazing. Anyway,
I am amazed.
Thank you very much. So we'll we've got a couple other people who may want to testify. Although my list has disappeared.
I'm sorry.
Is it there? Okay. Bob Seward and Randy Dell. You're from the Department of Education.
I am, sir.
All right.
My name is, for the record, my name is Bob Seward. I work for the Oregon Department of Education and Curriculum Instruction, Associate Superintendent. We've come to provide additional clarity that the committee may want to have concerning homeschooling and graduation requirements. We have actually one concern about this bill, and that is the term equivalency as it applies to high school graduation. There really are disparate activities, homeschooling and high school graduation, that have no linkages around standards. And so the concern is to ensure that some consistent, coherent set of standards are applied across all the educational opportunities kids have in the state, including homeschooling and alternative education, charter schools and private schools and public schools. We would want to deal with the issues of standards.
Let me ask you this question. Public high schools, do all of the students graduating from public high schools have to likewise pass competency tests?
The State Board of Education recently adopted a rule that requires proficiency, students meeting a set of proficiency standards for graduation with a regular high school diploma.
Are those the same standards applied to homeschoolers?
No, they are not.
Why? What's the difference there? Why is
homeschooling law does not apply any set of standards to the course of study that the homeschooling parents may use with their children. The requirement, as a previous person who testified, there is a requirement that parents do test their children at grades 3, 5, 8, and 10 using a national standardized test of achievement. However, high school graduation in the state of Oregon exceeds the achievement test requirements that it also has to do with courses of study taught by qualified teachers.
Right. Senator Brady.
In a high school, it's really the function of grades to determine how students are progressing, isn't that correct? In standard high school?
That's true at this point, although the proficiency standards that the state board has now has adopted and will be contemplating how to put those into effect will exceed grades as the measure.
All right. So, and is that the No Child Left Behind federal act that's governing some of that, or is it something that's happening?
Tangentially, the No Child Left Behind Act requires the state to assess students in three content areas and may assess in additional content areas, but those same standards for assessments must apply to all children enrolled in public schools or approved schools through the Department of Education. However, that still does not address all standards applied to children who receive a high school diploma. Those will always exceed the test requirements at the grades assessed.
All right. Thank you very much for your testimony. I appreciate it. I've lost Senator Ringo here. He's now reading Governing Magazine, so We'll close the public hearing.
Mr. Chair, sorry, it all seemed pretty hypothetical if we were withdrawing the bill.
I know, but I was actually looking at the bill. Anyway, sorry.
Yeah, that, oh.
Some degree of interest. All right, close the public hearing. Take a little 5-minute break. We'll be back to discuss law enforcement training standards.
Mr. Chair, the gentleman is.
Way of, I guess, beginning a discussion on the adequacy of law enforcement training in Oregon, particularly the basic training levels of all police officers throughout the state. And the bill, in essence, would create a cause of action against the state for injuries from actions by police officers under certain circumstances, and it sets a training program, a basic certification standard of not less than 20 weeks in duration, and then also in Section 3 adds a number of additional courses that officers would be trained in, statutory, constitutional law, civil rights, and use of force, etc. So, Diane Middle, you've been so kind as to appear here today. We've got a crowd that has appeared over this bill. There are protests on the steps of the Capitol regarding this issue, but you and I have had ongoing dialogues about this for a number of years. Senator Ringo.
I am heartened that you would introduce a bill creating a civil cause of action. I just appreciate that.
Well, I do believe that people have the right to a public and sometimes a judicial forum for redresses against their government. And I guess the chair's opinion, having been a police officer for now 27 years, is that when the state empowers individuals with the powers of the police to deprive people of their liberties and in some instances their very lives, that is a very significant grant of power or sanction. So to the extent that law enforcement officers are given a certain level of training, which the chair considers to be woefully inadequate, that the state, who's the primary party responsible for training and setting standards, ought to be culpable for the inadequate levels of training. I think that it will be clear that local governments, particularly cities and counties, pick up most of the tab for the defense of officers and their actions. And I don't believe that the state picks up or defends local law enforcement agencies on many of these issues, other than where a state police officer or a state law enforcement officer might also be involved in that particular incident. So, Diane, I know that you are to some extent constrained in your remarks because you are an executive department administrator, but I would like to have some open discussion about the adequacy of training in law enforcement in Oregon, and if you could maybe give some background on where we've been, where we're trying to get to, and how well we've accomplished that objective.
Kind of a brief historical overview. The state first began having those discussions on law enforcement training back in the early 60s, and at that point in time, the state recognized that the kind of train by the last person that you sat next to was probably not the way to do it anymore, and created then an advisory committee that looked at establishing standards for the state of Oregon. That, in fact, happened along with the funding base to support it. By 1971, we had the Board on Police Standards and Training and a funding base, and I believe at that point in time we were at about approximately 4 weeks of training. From that, over time, in terms of the Board on Public Safety Standards and Training and the department, of course, we've added a lot of other entities. But for police and law enforcement training in particular, we went to the point where the state was authorizing 8 weeks of training, and that continued right up until 1999. But in 1997, the legislature took a long look at the extent of training in Oregon, and at that point it was realized that 8 weeks was not sufficient. In 1997, the rest of the country had gone to 16 weeks of basic police training, while Oregon was still at 8 weeks. In 1997, this legislative body approved DPSST going to 16 weeks of training. An attempt was made to get there, but because of the facility shortfalls, it was absolutely impossible to do that. The only way to get that would have been to no longer be training corrections officers or parole and probation officers or firefighters or anyone else. So by 1999, we were directed to begin planning for a new facility that would actually handle 16 weeks of basic police training. Since that point, we've been working on that process. And in October of this year, we're given approval on the design to go forward with construction. However, as you all know, we're in budget shortfalls at this point in time. So we are now at the place where design development has been completed. It is designed as minimally adequate. It is designed to handle 16 weeks of law enforcement training, as well as maintaining the other disciplines at their current levels. I should tell you that at this point in time, as we're moving or attempting to move into building a 16-week facility, the national average is now between 22 and 24 weeks. So we have continued to remain well behind what most of the rest of the country is doing. So we are at 10 weeks currently with a national average at about 22 to 24. Now, the new facility, as you know, is struggling, obviously, with the funding issues that we have right now. But should that go forward, this facility is designed to do something that we've not been able to do in Oregon, which is very, very significant for a law enforcement officer's training. And that's to combine knowledge with application. Because of our limitations, much of the training that we do has been strictly education knowledge based. We work in scenarios and lifelike situations wherever we can, but it's very difficult because we don't have the kind of training venues where you can do that safely. I know a couple of you at least toured the facility and got an opportunity to see some of the things that we've done in terms of, for example, doing building searches. We do that in basements, in dorm rooms, in the hallways, wherever we can while the regular business is going on. We also use a state park for learning how to do traffic stops. And I will tell you, on more than one occasion, even though we've had it posted, I think we have scared or frightened people who thought they were coming to the state park either to use the restrooms or to view wildlife in the wildlife refuge. None of those are very good ways of training. We have absolutely no ability to do any kind of nighttime training, any kind of nighttime firearms training. And so what you lose is the reality of training. So an officer will go to work for their particular agency and they'll have theory, but they will not have had an adequate opportunity to actually apply that theory and know that they can do it. One of the biggest concerns that comes from that is if a person really can't apply the skills, they are more apt to respond out of fear. When people respond out of fear, they will have a tendency to go to a higher level of force or resistance than if they fully understand all the things that are available to them. As you know, when we talk about the use of force continuum, the first thing we talk about is presence, communication, and speech. One of the things that we're noticing, especially as this new generation starts training, is they are severely lacking in communication skills. They don't talk with a lot of people. They don't do one-on-one. They do computers. They do phones. We're finding when we put them even in very basic, little simple scenarios, they just stand there. It doesn't even occur to them what to say to somebody or how to build the conversation. So while we've taught them about use of force, we're having to actually go back and teach them how to start communicating, how to diffuse a situation, how to talk their way through things so they don't go to the tried and true, which may be a much higher level of force than they needed for the particular situation. There are a number of things that we're not even able to get to in 10 weeks. For instance, we don't even get to solo officer operations. Because we're dealing with 40 students in a classroom, there is no way that they can go out and practice how they would handle an incident on their own, because we're trying to get as many officers a chance to even try responding to a situation that they have to do it in groups. And so you may have a group of three people responding to an incident. Only one of them will actually be the person who has the opportunity to try and talk to a suspect or talk to a person who's on drugs or talk to the domestic violence victim or have the chance to interview a child. So they may have never actually done these things. They may have only watched them while they were at the academy, and then you need to hope that they can apply it. the whole reason that more training and more time for training and the right kind of equipment is necessary is so that officers can risk making those mistakes, and the worst that happens is they get laughed at by their counterparts, but they've got the chance to try it, to figure out where their weaknesses are, then go back and try it again and do it right. And that's probably one of the most critical things that we miss now in our ability to train. We talk a lot about diversity. We talk a lot about ethics. And I think officers probably are criticized for some of those aspects of their decision-making, probably more than anything else. But the reality is, unless they have time to practice in high-stress situations to see what their natural response is, they're not going to know how to control what might be their first response to something and actually get to the one that would be the appropriate or the right response under law, or might be one that allows them to defuse the situation. What we are asking them to do is very high-level decision-making, and that high-level decision-making is best achieved when they have a great deal of comfort with their skills, with the standards that are set, with the laws, so they can quickly apply them. Without that, they're searching for an answer, or they're just doing an immediate response. And what we're asking for from officers is a lot more complex than that. That was kind of a long history, but that's sort of where we sit.
Actually, I think it's the beginning of a fairly good discussion. I'm noticing that we actually have a disparity of training with the Department of State Police, who have a little bit over 19 weeks of training, but all other agencies are subject to roughly 10 weeks of basic training. And I'm trying to approach this from the perspective that we are, as a state, consciously moving towards a goal or an objective of adequacy in law enforcement training. But current law allows that training to be constricted by, as it says, training requirements shall be consistent with the funding available in the department's legislatively approved budget. So it's fascinating to me that we have this responsibility that we've taken on to train law enforcement officers, yet we've done ourselves a very inadequate job of doing so. Where do you see law enforcement training moving to in the immediate future?
Chairman, hopefully in spite of our budget difficulties, we'll find a way to move the facility forward. I know that the governor is working in that direction and has recommended the certificates of participation go forward. At this point in time, we're going to experience at least another year's delay if it moves forward and we can keep the funding that's being established at this point in time. We should have the facility operational by the fall of 2006. That will get us to 16 weeks of law enforcement training. The discussions that have occurred about what's next, and the facility obviously is designed in such a way that it can have some future growth, but the reality is Oregon is a very diverse state with some very diverse needs. And so the discussion has focused around 16 weeks being an appropriate amount of basic training. In other words, that initial training that would allow an officer to function safely in their community. Obviously, because of the nature of this work, training can't stop at just a one-time dose. You need to be continually working and upgrading those skills. There's still much more to learn, plus making sure that your perishable skills do stay sharp. So the discussion has been that from that point forward, we work towards developing regional training sites, and we have begun that process over the last couple of biennia, and we're building on that process. The regional sites would allow then for each part of the state to create what their intermediate and advanced looks like so it meets particular agency needs. So, for example, Portland Police Bureau has very different needs as a metropolitan police agency, as you well know, from, say, the Ontario Police Department. And so they're looking at a different skill set in the intermediate and advanced officer. So the design was to then create that regional perspective where you still maintain standards, you still maintain the perishable skills in a measurable way so that an officer does have credibility, and especially when things do go wrong, an officer and an agency can rely on that past training, even though it doesn't need to be identical from beyond basic. it is critical that every officer has a basic education or basic training that is similar so that they can communicate, they can respond, they can work together when they're called upon to do that. But after that, they do need to specialize as it relates to their particular agency and their particular region. As I indicated, we had begun that process of setting up the regional units. Again, because of budget shortfalls, it appears that we may be losing that regional development that we have begun. So again, that it's another funding issue that we're having to address and look at. But in any event, I think the thinking behind that is still very sound. It's just, does the state have the available funding to make that go forward at this point in time?
Right. Diane, how much training do officers get in basic on statutory and constitutional law currently?
Chairman, as I didn't bring the, I should have brought that with me, the chart of how much they get in each area. I would just be guessing, so let me bring that to you. I can bring you the breakdown of courses. What we're trying to do is not only give them the statutory and case law, and I think it's about 8 days total in the law area. But beyond just getting the theoretical bookwork of the law, what we're trying to do is get the officer to understand how to research, how to analyze law, so that we're not saying, you know, here's assault, here's the elements, you know, memorize it. What we want them to do is to be able to understand the concept as well. And what that takes is for them to see a situation, be in a situation, and figure out what laws are involved. So when we give an actual number of how many hours are spent teaching constitutional law, statutory law, that's a little bit misleading because that would be the classroom. Then there's the other part that's the application. Can they recognize when they see the offense? Can they write the report about that offense? And can they deal with it? So that happens in the scenario setting. I can get you some hours.
Oh, in the constitutional law section, is that where you discuss issues like search and seizure? Or is that a separate class?
Senator Minnis, that's where they first learn the concepts of search and seizure, but then again, also they do practice and recognize those at a crime scene when possible.
So is there a separate class on search and seizure?
There is.
Rules of evidence, et cetera. Civil rights, how much class time?
I can't answer that. I'll have to get you the numbers on the class hours.
Use of force?
Same thing. I have to get you the class hours.
All right.
And I can do that.
Senator Walker, question?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Middle, do people making application to be a police officer have to have any college experience at all?
Chairman and Senator Walker, not by state standard, they do not, but many individual agencies have a college standard. That's been a goal, but that has not been. The Board on Public Safety Standards and Training sets the minimum standard for the state, and the minimum standard is the high school education. Other agencies require more than that for some obvious reasons.
So let me follow up, if I might. So the minimum standard is a high school education, so you could get someone who only went to high school, goes into training and gets 10 weeks of training, and then they're out there on the street trying to communicate and reason with people and do their job effectively, correct?
Chairman and Senator Walker, that is correct.
That's very scary.
All right. Let's see. So you're going to bring back some additional information.
I will.
Now, I'm trying to remember, back in my college days, the 1968 Omnibus Crime Control Act, the federal government did quite a bit of work on issues of professionalization in law enforcement and made recommendations and standards. Has there been any work subsequent to that by the Congress or the federal government on police standards?
Chairman, I'm not aware of any work that's being done on national standards. I, as a director of an agency, belong to a group that's the International Association of Directors of Law Enforcement Standards and Training. And we quite, when we do meet, that's one of the things we talk about is what is the base minimum standards, what should they look like. But there, to my understanding, there's no formal group that's actually trying to set a national standard.
All right. And just for the committee, for the record, would you explain how you're funded, how your agency's funded?
Yes, for the, all the criminal justice programs were funded through the criminal fines and assessment account public safety fund. For our fire folks, for fire insurance premium tax. For our telecommunicators, it's the 911 excise tax. And for private security, that's a fee-based division.
Yes, Senator Brady.
What provisions, if any, do you have at the DPSSP? If you get an officer, if you accept an officer for training, and through the course of that training, you find that the person is not temperamentally suited to police work, for example, might be overly aggressive or has thought patterns that might lead to trouble, what do you do in those circumstances?
Chairman and Senator Burdick, first we work with the student to see if this is a learning issue and just something they need to be exposed to. But if we determine that, in fact, it is a character flaw or something that would not make this person suitable to law enforcement work, we first work with their agency to withdraw them. If it's serious enough, we dismiss them from the academy. If they do not complete academy training, they're not eligible for certification. They cannot be an officer. And that has happened on several occasions.
Yeah, to follow up, on several occasions, does this happen often? And, you know, how do your recruits, how do your trainees do, like, in their first year or two of police work? Do you find that you're missing people? Or?
Chairman and Senator Burdick, one of the real benefits that's come from are beginning to add scenarios and situations where they're not just sitting there as students as we can see this behavior, because it comes out and it shows throughout the training. I mean, you'll see the aggressive natures show up on the firing range. You'll see it when they're doing defensive tactics. You can see it in their interactions with their fellow students. So as we began doing that, we began seeing people that we might not have caught or come to our attention early on, and so we have had more of that. I forgot the second part of your question here as I was going on that track.
How are they doing on their first year or two in that regard?
Thank you. That's one of the things we have begun doing is once they finish basic police training, they go to a field training officer and complete a field training manual. What we're now doing is following up with a survey that goes with each student to find out how they're doing. Did the agency get what they expected from the student? Did they have a grasp of the basic knowledge? And then how are they doing through that field training manual? What we're then hoping to do is follow that with a five-year down-the-road survey to see did the students we expected to do well, in fact, do well in the profession?
One other issue. I think it should be made clear to the committee the level of insight your organization has with respect to the conduct of officers or complaints filed against officers once they leave and to graduate from your training program. You also have a disciplinary function as a board in terms of revocation certifications, et cetera. But does your agency follow or monitor how many complaints are filed against police officers for excessive force or violation of civil rights or these kind of complaint filings within the various agencies, or are you reliant upon the local governments that hire and employ these individuals to report to you those incidents?
Chairman, it's to some extent we rely on the agencies to report. However, the way our statute and rules are set up, that we are required to take action no matter how we find out about something. So if we find out about it through a media report or we find out about it through a citizen complaint, then we're obligated to at least make inquiry. We do not have, per se, an investigative unit then that would go out and do an independent investigation. We would have to wait till an agency finished their internal review or a criminal case were completed or something of that nature, and then we're required to take action.
So it's at least theoretically possible that an officer could be at least administratively charged in their agency with some violation of their rules or procedures, dismissed from their employment, and your agency would have no specific knowledge of the facts surrounding the discharge?
Chairman, we are notified if an officer is discharged. And if an officer is discharged for cause, as is defined in our statutes, then we are required to take action.
And if they're asked to go away?
Chairman, is if they just go away, we have no recourse. We won't. In other words, if, for example, someone were under disciplinary action and they chose to resign, at this point in time, we would not know that, and we would not have the ability to take action.
All right. And are you aware of any incidences where individuals have been asked to go away to avoid either criminal charges or?
Chairman, as we hear anecdotally of it fairly often.
I see. All right.
Did you say
we're
fairly
gonna
often? Fairly often, oh, we fairly hear that people have resigned. And
all right. Well, this, I think, is a pretty good beginning. Yeah, go ahead with your question, and I'm going to conclude with a couple of remarks and land-based the governor's office.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I actually like this bill. I think it needs to be reduced from 20 to 16 and do the regional training because it is a significant cost. But I have two questions. One, is there continuing education and continuing training that officers are doing? I mean, that's the focus of the regional centers, but is there anything now?
Chairman and Senator Walker, most agencies continue their officer training, and it's at varying degrees and various types depending on what they have available. Some agencies actually have training officers. Others do not because they're so very small. Over half of our law enforcement agencies are under 10 people in this state, so that's very difficult for them to have a training officer. The Board on Public Safety Standards and Training and the Police Policy Committee are currently in the process of looking at mandatory maintenance standards, and they're doing that as a minimum maintenance standard as to what should be the base level of training that continues with an officer, especially as it relates to the perishable survival skills.
And then my second question is, this last session I worked on a bill on racial profiling that we passed in this legislative assembly, and one of the issues that came up was to increase training of an officer during their 16 weeks of training so that they can better be equipped to deal with these issues. And I thought what was interesting was your comment about the communication issues, that they don't really have good communication skills because we're focusing on all these other things. But I think it's relevant and important for people in Oregon to know that we're trying to address these issues, but we're not getting the training. And we did discuss that with regard to the racial profiling bill.
Chairman and Senator Walker, that is correct. We did, and you know, as you know, a very good program came out of that. It's regretful that we don't have enough time to spend and give it the depth that it needs, but we don't at this point in time. So again, it's one of those things that they're given a familiarization about, but not a chance to really learn. And we do work very diligently on communication, right along with defensive tactics and everything. In fact, I think you're probably aware, as in the terms of developing our curriculum, we went to what we refer to as a seven themes enhanced curriculum, mm-hmm. so that when an officer's learning, they aren't learning just defensive tactics, that at the same time they're learning how to apply defensive tactics in an ethical way, doing it with sensitivity towards diversity, doing it with communications, you know, paying attention to whether or not they have a health and a fitness issue, you know, are there legal issues. And so they incorporate all of those themes with everything they're doing, and what we're trying to give them is a base from which they can make a sound decision regardless of the situation that they happen to be in, whether it's a high-intensity one or whether it's a low-intensity. And if they know how to gauge themselves and their approach, everything from a very low-level, non-threatening approach all the way up to the ultimate show of force, but everything in between. And that's the difficult challenge, is to give them the skills to deal with everything in between.
And I'm sorry, there's one last question because it continues to bother me that we can let just high school students come and be police officers. Is there an age requirement so at least these people could have a little more life experience before they become a police officer?
Chairman and Senator Walker, they must be 21 years of age.
Thank you. That helps me a little bit.
All right. My closing comments. I'm noticing in the fiscal analysis that it would cost, according to their estimate, roughly $5.4 million, quote, just for staff and supplies to achieve the goals of this bill beginning January of 2007. The Risk Management Division estimates 200 claims per biennium with damages paid out on 26. They also estimate self-insurance fund experience an increase in claims cost, including legal defense costs, of more than $5 million. for biennium. So it appears to me to be fairly cost neutral, except it also appears to me that the most fiscally, well, not sound, but limited methodology is to simply bury our heads in the sand and ignore that there may be a problem out there at all. I am dismayed that Ms. Milton, Ms. Middle, you are the only person who signed up to testify. There is no one from the Chiefs of Police Association, no one from the Sheriff's Association, no one from any law enforcement union, no one from the governor's office, no one from any other aspect of the law enforcement community. I see the city of Portland represented here. I see the leader of Oregon counties or the counties represented here, and there may be some other folks tangentially here. I find it personally offensive that these organizations would not be present, specifically the governor's office, because in my experience as a law enforcement officer, when you give people the power to take someone's life or to take away their civil liberties and you ignore a very obvious problem by burying your head in the sand and using budget concerns as an excuse, I think that it is inexcusable. I don't endorse the filing of civil lawsuits per se just for the sake of filing them. But I do think that the state needs to take a very serious look at the level of training, the content of training for local law enforcement officers around the state. Ms. Middle, it's my opinion that you have been short-sheeted and short-changed in terms of dollars for training. It is the current governor's budget is inconsistent with the agreements that were reached during the last administration with respect to training funds and the programs for the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. It's the chair's intent to continue to pursue these issues to the extent that it is possible. And given that, I'm going to conclude, but I'm going to continue to raise these issues and continue to point out the inconsistencies in what we say and what we do. And frankly, I don't want to hear any complaints from any members of the Senate regarding the conduct or actions of police officers, particularly as it might relate to the training or the lack of training given police officers without the Senate or the members of this legislature's commitment to the training of those officers. With that, I'm adjourned.
There you go. Here.